Okay. Go ahead and open us with prayer, and we'll get started. Lord God, thank you for your mercies and your grace, and for bringing us all here this morning. And we pray that you would speak to us something fresh, especially as we turn our hearts, our ears, and our minds to your first coming and what that meant and what it still means for us. And let us gain something new, a new aspect we hadn't seen before this morning. In Jesus' name, amen. Now that is a sincere prayer because I'm not doing something new this morning. Last year about this time, I gave a Bible study about like I'm about to give, but maybe a little different. We looked at Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, and his birth story. Last year we also looked at the genealogy first, but that is certainly a whole nother ball of wax. We're not going to look at that today. Today we're going to look in chapter 2. So chapter 2 of Matthew. So we will actually skip. Of course, Matthew doesn't really have a birth story, does he? Luke is the one with our famous birth story. And that's the one we all know around Christmas time. We know it quite well. Matthew is the one that tells it from Joseph's perspective. And there are many links to birth stories in the Bible and to Joseph. And if you read through the genealogy, some of the stories highlighted there, like Tamar and Judah, Joseph becomes the righteous person in comparison to someone like Judah. And there are some interesting links there. But for time, we're going to skip ahead. And we are going to start in chapter 2. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, Esther.
Hi.
Sorry, really?
That's fine. It's actually quite typical. Yeah, you're right on time. The Middle East. So we're looking, because it's Advent, we're looking at Matthew 2. Which I started off saying was Matthew's birth story, but I have to correct myself. He actually doesn't talk about the birth. So if everyone has a Bible, you can open to Matthew 2. If you don't have a Bible, there are various Bibles over there. In English and German and Hebrew and Russian. Okay. So let's do some reading. Would like to read? I guess just one verse. Actually, we could just read through. No, we better take it chunk by chunk. So, okay, two verses. Who wants to read two verses? Matthew 2, verses 1 and 2.
Perfect. Jesus was born in the town of Bethlehem in Judea during the reign of King Herod. About that time, some wise men from the Eastlands arrived in Jerusalem, asking, "Where is the newborn King of the Jews? We have seen his star as it arose, and we have come to worship him."
Okay. All right. Actually, the bulk of what I want to say this morning comes from these verses. So compared to Luke, Matthew just says, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea. Kind of a very quick passing over of that whole story. But Matthew is weaving in different things. He has a different picture in his mind of what he wants to convey. Okay, so he mentions that Bethlehem is in Judea. This is maybe for two reasons. Bethlehem of Judah It's also mentioned in 1 Samuel 17:12 that it's in Judah. We are going to pick up on some of these themes contrasting Judah, so we're going to pay attention. So let me see. Now David, I'm reading from 1 Samuel 17:12. Now David was the son of an Ephrati of Bethlehem, in Judah, named Jesse, who had 8 sons. Okay, so from this we know the first king of Israel, well, not the first king, the ideal first king. Saul, of course, is the first king. But David comes from Bethlehem of Judah. And it's an Ephrati. He's an Ephratite. And Ephrat is somehow connected to Bethlehem, same area. So Matthew mentions it's Bethlehem of Judah because he is talking about the coming Messiah, who of course is an idealized form of David. So it's significant he mentions Judah because of the Davidic line and Bethlehem. And also, if you look in Joshua 19:15, look there really quick. Joshua 19:15. Okay. Actually, starting verse 14. Then on the north, the boundary turns about to Hanaton and it ends at the valley of Yiftahel. I'm reading this in English, so the names won't sound right. And Katat, Nahalal, Shimron, Idala, and Bethlehem. 12 cities with their villages. This is the inheritance of the people of Zvulun, according to their clans, these cities with their villages. Well, where is Zvulun? It's in the north. Okay, so there is a Bethlehem in the north of the country.
There is.
Yes, there is. And so...
But it's not Ephrata.
It's not Ephrata. So another reason to mention that Bethlehem of Judah is to specify not the northern Bethlehem, which you may have thought because Jesus' family lives in Nazareth, but the southern Bethlehem, the actual Bethlehem of Judah, which is where David was from. And then he mentions in the days of Herod. Now this is more than just telling us time, because Matthew wants us to think about Herod. Who is Herod? We're talking about Herod the Great here. Tell me what you know about Herod the Great.
He was a great architect.
He was a great architect.
That's
yes,
why
he was.
The great.
That's why he was called the Great. He loved to build. He had you could say a building complex. He had a very large ego, and he took it out.
He frightened a few people.
He was also paranoid to keep his power, and he was willing to kill relatives, whoever it took to retain his power. Now let me ask you on that line, why would he be paranoid about losing power? Was he legitimate? Who was he? He was what?
A convert.
A convert? Yeah, you could say a convert. He was not a Jew according to Judaism of his day. His father was Antipater, an Idumean, which if you trace Idumean, that's the Greek name for Edom, right? So he's an Edomite, and his mother is Arabian. So he's not exactly from the line of David. Although ironically, David did spend time in Edom. Yeah, there's all kinds of ancient tensions going on here, which is part of what I want to look at. But he's insecure because he's not really legitimate. Who appointed him king then?
The Romans.
The Romans, yeah. Anthony. About 40 BC, he became king. So he's at the end of his career, And usually people who are paranoid and getting older, they become more paranoid. And he has known, he's ruled with brute force. That's how he's maintained his power. And at the end of his career, this is when these things are starting to happen. Okay, so with this background, what did our story say?
It's 10 hours.
Sorry, let me flip back to Matthew 2. Behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born King of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." This is amazing. There's many questions I want to ask about this verse here. And we will start with wise men. Who are these wise men?
Astrologers,
you could say. They're looking at stars. The Greek just has magi, which are magicians. So, it's interesting. Gary, maybe you have something to say about...
People called them magicians,
yeah,
because they couldn't understand them.
Are you trying to say they're not magicians?
Well, magicians means a different meaning. The people generally couldn't understand their knowledge of the stars and etc.
Okay.
They called them that, didn't they? Yeah.
That could be a reason.
I think it could take a different reason.
That people didn't understand them, so they call them...
Magic.
Magic,
yeah.
Or they could be magicians.
Agree.
And also have some kind of schooling and wisdom. It's an interesting connection. And if you think in terms of the Bible and how people perceived, we'll ask another question: where is the East? Because it's interesting. I was talking this past week in America. And other countries in the West, we used to call people from the Far East Oriental. Far East, I'm talking about China, Korea, Japan. And now you cannot say Oriental. That's not politically correct. It is a negative. I don't know why, but I think the reasoning is because to call them Oriental means that you think you're the center of the world and they're east from you. But they could call you Oriental because, you know, depending which way you look, you could be east from them, depending which way around the globe you go. So, anyway, so we don't use the word Oriental anymore. But this brings up the point, what is east? It's subjective to where you're standing and how far east is east. And in some cases, from Israel's perspective, it's this tiny little country in what we call today the Middle East. And east are all the people groups. It kind of combines many people groups. But let's throw them out there because I think it's important. We skip over a lot of geography when we read the Bible, and I think we lose something. So, do I have a pen? Let me see. I'll do again what I did last year. Oh, no, I won't.
Okay.
I'm going to go get a new pen. Okay, so let's say Israel is here. At the Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea. Okay, so you have Jerusalem's around here, Judah and Israel. What is on the high end, the north end of east? What people group sits across from the northern kingdom?
Arabians.
Okay, north and, yeah, depending how high you start. Just to the north and east, we would have Aram. Wow, thank you. I was going to bring a nice little map, but... Okay. This is my map of Israel. Why am I going to draw this line? Because
You've got to be careful in this country if you draw lines. Very dangerous thing to do. But this is the Sea of Galilee. This is the Jordan River. This is the Dead Sea.
Yeah.
So we have Judah. We have Israel. So if you read through Kings, what's the northern kingdom? Who are they always competing with?
Assyria.
Assyria. Before Assyria. Aram.
Or Syria
today. And then under Aram, think close to Israel. This is, we're zooming into the map because Israel isn't very big. So, who is the next one on this side under Aram? What people group? Above Moab.
Ammon.
So we call them Ammonites. Bnei Ammon. And then whatever little river separates them, Zered or Arnon.
Moab.
There's two rivers or Nahans. Then we have Moab, which we say Moab in English. And then under Moab, who is it?
Edom.
Maybe I should have shifted all this down a bit, because Edom starts under Moab and it kind of continues underneath. They're also the people from the south of Judah. Okay, so now let's think about characters in the Bible. Who comes from Aram?
Abraham.
Did you say everyone?
No.
Abraham. Abraham, who else?
David.
Okay.
Hazael.
Abraham didn't come from Aram.
Sure he did.
Halfway.
Was that part of Aram?
It was. We have the
same. I know it was Ur. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there were two Urs, just like there's two Bethlehem.
Exactly.
One was further south, but he was from the northern one. Because remember, he came to Haran. They lived in Haran many years. And in Numbers, when you bring the blessings of the first fruits, is it Numbers or Deuteronomy? I forget which passage. It talks about you give a recitation when you bring the first fruits from the land. And you say, my father was a wandering Aramaean. Referring to Abram first coming to the country.
Actually, he's talking about Jacob.
He could be talking about Jacob too. I mean, that's Abram's son.
Right, no, but he went over to, his father-in-law.
Right, which Abraham, Laban, I think is probably the biggest person you think of first when you think of Aram, because if you go back to the first story Laban's mentioned, it keeps saying, Laban ha-Arami, Laban the Aramaean.
Yeah.
And of course, Rebecca is Laban's sister, so they're married in. So that's an interesting connection, because later in history they're kind of enemies. They are enemies, and yet they're also kind of family if you go back far enough. Okay, where did the Ammonites come from?
Lot,
Abraham's nephew. And
Moab.
He has one kid who becomes the father of the Ammonites and one who is the father of the Moabites. Where did the Edomites come from?
Esau.
Any other name for Esau? Seir. Even Edom. And so this is fascinating. Because all of these enemies basically are family, but this one is particular because he's a twin brother. You have Jacob and Esau in the womb, and Jacob becomes Israel, and Esau becomes Edom.
So did Herod have, in inverted commas, the blood of Esau?
Well, he's an Edomian, so yeah, he's a half Edomite.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Midianites. I ran out of room. They're down there. Midianites. And they, of course, are close friends to Moses. He married into them. So you could say Moses' children are half Midianite. And in many biblical tradition, Midianites they're in cahoots with Moabites. But they also have dealings with the Ishmaelites. Ishmael, we don't have up here. But they are known for their trading down south into Egypt. But I think it's significant, the whole history of the Bible, the whole interplay with Edom and Judah. And they are, in the biblical tradition, if one is up, the other is down. They can't be both up at the same time. So it's a fascinating study if you just went through the whole Bible and looked at Israel, and then later just Judah and Edom. And we're going to look at some of those prophecies today. But as we're thinking also about East, if you want to go with the wise men idea of Magi, astrologers, where else do we have wisdom in the East in the Bible?
Job.
Job is a big, huge book full of wisdom. Where is Job from? Well, let's look in Jeremiah 25:20. I could look at it. Okay. So this is sweeping through all the different lands. We're talking about the cup of the Lord's wrath. It's going through the lands around them, some of the enemy, the other people. And it mentions all the kings of the land of Uz, and all the kings of the land of the Philistines. In verse 21, Edom, Moab, and the sons of Ammon. So we have mention of this Uz place. I guess we should have read Job 1 first. But you will see that Job is from the land of Uz. Nice little land to be from. So it's in with this list of Philistines, and it sweeps Philistines in Egypt, and it sweeps up through Edom, Moab, and the Ammonites. So it gives you this whole sweeping picture. So it doesn't fully help us know where Uz is. But it seems to be southern from Judah. And then look in Echa. Look in Lamentations 4:21. Who wants to read Lamentation 4:21? Anyone? You have it there, John?
Yeah, I got it. Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom, who dwells in the land of Uz.
There you go. Did you hear that? Mm-hmm. Daughter of Edom is parallel to Uz. So, maybe Job is also an Edomite. Now, I don't know what you think about that, but I think that's wild and crazy. Because it turns things on its head a little bit. You know, when God says, consider my servant Job, upright and innocent. Anyway, another one of Job's buddies is also Edomite, and he's got some Arabians in there. So we're dealing with these Eastern to Judah, like we're on the other side of the Yam HaMelach, the Dead Sea. Anything beyond here is considered east, right?
Mm.
But eastern and to the south a little bit.
But surely not taking the other way. Not all of the Edomites were, in inverted commas, bad people.
Sure. And the interesting thing, if you look at the Bible throughout, you have verses like, don't despise the Edomite because he's your brother.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet, what happened historically that changed everything?
Obadiah
and Ahaz, also, Lamentations is also post-exilic. When did the exile happen?
Give me the year. 586.
586?
Yeah.
BC, of course. Babylonians come and exile Judah. Of course, at that point, Israel had already been exiled over 100 years earlier. Who helped them?
The Edomites.
The Edomites. So the Edomites, how'd you say they...
Why don't you read that?
They gave over their brother. And so if you read prophets that are after the exile, after this time, they have nothing good to say about Edom. They become completely bad. If you read from the laws and from the older sections, Edom is still okay. So you're right. You can never stereotype completely,
well,
right?
Job emerges as an extremely good man.
Sure. And Job was a very ancient story.
Yeah, cursed God and died.
Right. You're right. And the Bible's full of such ironies. There is redemption everywhere, except for the Amalekites. But that's another thing. But here we have this tradition of wisdom being in the East. Sorry, you said to read a passage, Gary. What passage did you want? Okay, do you want to, what, the whole thing?
You have to read the whole thing and just point out the salient text of, the Edomites.
Okay,
it's
okay. Obadiah, let's go to Obadiah. It is a great little book. We shouldn't skip it. The Vision of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. We have heard a report from the Lord, and a messenger has been sent among the nations. Rise up, let us rise against her for battle. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You shall be utterly despised. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock, in your lofty dwelling, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? Though you soar aloft like the eagle, though your nest is set among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. Goes on. So why is he talking about rocks, high cliffs?
Because there's a lot of high rocky cliff things in Edom.
It's true. That whole area is like a rock plateau. So you look down over this Jordan Valley and the Dead Sea area. So they're high up, they're fortified, they can build into the rock, and you think you're so secure, but you're coming down too. And then look at this. Let's just keep reading. I'll just read. If thieves came to you, if plunderers came by night, how you would have been destroyed. Would they not steal only enough for themselves? If grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave gleanings? How Esau has been pillaged, his treasures sought out. All your allies have driven you to your border. Those at peace with you have deceived you. They have prevailed against you. Those who eat your bread have set a trap beneath you. You have no understanding. Ooh, now it's getting personal. Look at verse 8. Will I not on that day, declares the Lord, destroy the wise men out of Edom and understanding out of Mount Esau? So what does verse 8 tell us?
Well, it doesn't like them.
Well, there are wise men in Edom. There is understanding. There's a tradition that there's wise men in Edom and there's understanding out of Mount Esau, which is another name for Edom. And your mighty men shall be dismayed, O Teman. It's one of the cities there. So that every man from Mount Esau will be cut off by slaughter.
Teman is also connected to
this. South. Yeah, Teman.
Yemen.
It's going to come up. So remember in the Bible we're looking east. Okay, we're facing east. So if you turn to the right, Yamin, that's south.
If you turn to the left, Smol, that's north. If you speak Arabic, Shamal means north, also means left. Right, so you're oriented again, you're facing east. This also ties into this word we've been looking at, or imagining, because it's a Hebrew word we're looking at, Kedem, which means east in Hebrew. I'll write it. Kedem, and in English, I don't know, maybe like this, means east, but it also means ancient. And it depends on the context. And why does that make sense? Because if you're facing east, you're also in time, you're facing, you can see everything you've ever done. Right? The past is in front of you. And if you didn't see it personally, you can read about it. Someone can see it. But the future, no one can see. Right? The future is behind you. You're not facing it because you can't see it.
So you're walking backwards.
You're walking backwards into the future. That's right. So everything in Kedem, everything in front of you, is ancient in a time perspective. So that's that relation between east and the time.
Like in
ancient.
Like in Micah 5, verse 1.
Like in Micah 5, where we're going to in a moment, yeah. Momentarily.
In that too, not exactly on what you're saying, but the Sphinx representing the wisdom of man and the strength of the lion faces east. The point I'm making is those people at that time had some appreciation of the east.
Sure. Well, the east is where the sun rises.
Sure.
Yeah. Where would we be without the sun?
Sure.
Now, if you're thinking about Utz, let's also look at Genesis 10, 23. This gets interesting. The sons of Aram. Okay? So Aram is up there, Syria. These are the sons of Syria, sons of Aram. Utz. Hul, Geter, and Mash. So they go on. So Uz is a son of Aram. So that's interesting. And then if you look at 1 Chronicles, chapter 1:17, First Chronicles 1:17. The sons of Shem, so they're Semitic, Elam, Ashur, Arpachshad, Lud, and Aram. And the sons of Aram, Utz, Hul, Geter, and Meshech. So again, Utz. So somehow Utz is connected to Aram, which is up north. And that's very interesting. So we have Utz connected both to Edom and to Aram. And I can't tell you why. But everything I see in Matthew seems to be connected to Edom and Aram. So it's an interesting parallel. Because now we are going to ask another question. Thinking about wise men from the east. And there's this wisdom tradition. There's a bunch of wise men down there. Who else in the Bible is from the mountains of the east? Harare Kedem, it says. Think
Balaam?
Way back. That's right. Balaam in English, or Bilam. Look with me. Okay, who is Balaam? Just tell me who he is. He's a prophet. Okay. He's this character. We don't know exactly. He seems to receive things from God, words from God, and yet he is definitely not Israelite. He's definitely not practicing, you know, biblical worship and tradition. And yet he hears from God. So he's this peculiar character. We might call him a magician. We might call him a prophet.
And he delivers his messages in beautiful poetry, just like prophets in the Bible. So so maybe you could call him a wise man too, I don't know.
And he has a bad end.
Yeah, and he's one of those characters, how you interpret his character changes through the time as well. Because originally, he doesn't look quite as bad. But with more and more time, he becomes Bilam the wicked.
Is that why people refer to Balaam as a bad prophet?
That, and because there are several passages in the New Testament that allude to Balaam the false prophet, kind of the prophecies of Bilam. And so you have to follow the whole tradition and what it was in Jesus' day and Paul's day, how they were interpreting. But the interesting thing about this character is already in Jesus' day, they were interpreting the oracles he gave, his prophecies, as messianic. And so I think Matthew is thinking about Bilam when he's telling you Jesus' birth story. So I want us to read from Numbers 23. Specifically, the first verse of his oracle, which starts in verse 7. So first of all, you remember the story that Balak is the king of Moab, and he's the one that calls Bilam. So Bilam has got quite a lot of, he's popular, he's famous. Okay, so here's his prophecy he delivers. From Aram, Balak has brought me, the king of Moab from the eastern mountains. So Bilam says he's from Aram, and that Balak has summoned him out of the eastern mountains, or Harere Kedem. And why has he summoned him? To come curse Jacob. And so he says, how can I curse whom God has not cursed? How can I denounce whom the Lord has not denounced? For from the top of the crags I see him. From the hills I behold him. Behold, a people dwelling alone and not counting itself among the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob or number the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the upright and let my end be like his. Okay, so that's his first oracle where he tells us where he's from. And Well, we'll read the second one before. So let's listen to the second oracle. Balak asks him to try again because he's trying to curse these people, not bless them.
The
second one is 23 as well. Okay.
It's come with me to another place.
Yeah, he comes to another place. He gives another prophecy. And this time, he basically, I mean, you could scan through it, verse 18 to 24.
Why is God saying to Balaam, curse Israel?
No, Balak is asking. Balak is the king of Moab.
Oh, I see.
He's afraid of Israel. He sees them coming on the way out of Egypt. And so he calls Bilam. Wherever Bilam was living, I don't know, but he claims to be from Aram. And he says, curse this people for me. And so Bilam, why do I think Bilam is a magician? Well, because he's kind of setting up, you know, you have to do this, let's do a sacrifice, we're going to have seven, and do it this way, and then God's going to meet me. So it all kind of sounds like practices you would find in any divination in the ancient Near East. But God really does meet him. And instructs him what to say, and he can't say anything against Israel. He says in 23, for there is no enchantment against Jacob, no divination against Israel. So he's referencing magical things, right? He's saying, I can't work magic against these people. Now it shall be said of Jacob and Israel what God has wrought. Behold the people, as a lioness it rises up, and as a lion it lifts itself. It does not lie down until it has devoured the prey and drunk the blood of the slain. Wow, so that's pretty powerful imagery. Okay, so they're going to try. Balak is desperate. He's going to try one more time to get a curse out of Bilam. So in chapter 24, we read in verse 3, the oracle of Bilam, the son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eye is opened, the oracle of him who hears the words of God, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down with his eyes uncovered. Kind of describes an ecstatic experience there. And so what does he get from the Lord? Verse 5, how lovely are your tents, O Jacob, your encampments, O Israel, like palm groves that stretch afar, like gardens beside a river, like aloes that the Lord has planted, like cedar trees beside the waters. Water shall flow from his buckets, and his seed shall be in many waters. His king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. God brings him out of Egypt, and is for him like the horns of the wild ox. By the way, who is Agag?
Amalekite
king. The Amalekite king. And Jacob's king is going to be higher than Agag. He shall eat up the nations, his adversaries, and shall break their bones in pieces and pierce them through with his arrows. He crouched, he lay down like a lion, and like a lioness, who will rouse him up? Blessed are those who bless you, and cursed are those who curse you. Okay. And there's one more final oracle, 3a4. So let's look at verse 15 of chapter 24. And this is the one that really gets the messianic spin. The oracle of Bilam, the son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eyes opened, the oracle of him who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down with his eyes uncovered. I see him, but not now. Okay, so that line is what made people think messianically, because here is something a little different. So far he's described this beautiful people he can see from the hilltops and, you know, blessing, they're going to multiply, yada, yada, yada. But now it's something, what I'm talking about is not right now. It's in the future more. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab and break down all the sons of Shet. Edom will be dispossessed. Seir also, his enemy, shall be dispossessed. Israel is doing valiantly. And one from Jacob shall exercise dominion and destroy the survivors of cities. Okay? So you have this picture of this future something. So we're going to interpret this messianically. What is our metaphors? What do we see here?
Kochav.
Kochav nolad. We have a star. So the star is either the sign of this person, or it is the person. And of course we have people throughout history who've claimed to be the star. And a scepter. A scepter is obviously a symbol of a king. So we have this person who's coming out of Jacob, who is a star or a scepter. Now, when the wise men come to Herod, what do they say?
We have seen a star in the east, and have come to worship.
Yeah.
They have seen a star in the east. Well, this is also interesting, because they're in the east. Anatole is east, but it's also rising, and it's sprouting up. So it could be we've seen a star while we were in the east, which of course they started in the east, or we saw a star rising, which can connect either of those interpretations. However you interpret it, I think leads you back to this passage of Bilam, who is an eastern magician prophesying that some person in the future is going to come out of Jacob. And he is either a star, or a star will be a sign about him. And it uses the word darach. So when we translate it, a star shall come out of Jacob, that's already
interpreting
it, yeah. Darach, you could say, this is bivok, you know, the step. Stand, or you could say also, yeah, marching, or also it could be somehow ruling.
And you could do it to your enemies.
Yeah, you could step on your enemies. And it does say that they're going to, what does it say? He's going to smash the Moabites and Edom. He's going to crush the forehead of Moab, and he's going to dispossess Edom. Okay. So,
and this is written in the Dead Sea Scrolls. They like this.
They like this. The way we know that this passage was already interpreted messianically is because some of our ancient translations already interpret some of these words. Instead of just a star, they'll say a person. They have slight differences from the Hebrew. And you see this reflected both in the Aramaic translation and in the Greek translation. So there's, over the course of, in the days of Jesus, slightly before and slightly after, there was this messianic expectation when people read these passages.
But the expression of star can be a metaphor.
Yeah, yeah, for sure it's a metaphor. Yeah. Right.
Doesn't mean a physical star.
And yet, look in Matthew. You have both. You have the metaphoric understanding, and you have the physical understanding, because these people have seen a star.
Yes.
That's why they're there. But how did they know that there was going to be this star from Jacob? And that's why I think Matthew wants us to connect it to Bilam, to these prophecies. Because presumably, he lived in the East, and he wrote down these wisdom things, and then his disciples, people would have access to these texts and be expecting. So when they saw this new thing, they would say, hey, it's a king of the Jews. This anticipated person is finally coming. And so their response is, part of that messianic fulfillment is that we need to go and bow down to them. Like, we are subject to this king of the Jews. So this ancient rivalry back and forth is reversing. And so notice in back in Matthew, Herod is troubled in all of Jerusalem. And why is Herod troubled again? Because he's not really Jewish.
Yeah.
And according to Josephus, Antiquities of the Jews, chapter or book 17, 2-4, the Pharisees had already predicted that Herod was going to be removed from power. So what does Herod do? He calls together, look in your text in Matthew. Who does he call together? Sadducees and scribes. So he wants to know if this could possibly be true and what kind of text he's working with. But he doesn't want to ask the Pharisees because he knows they're against him anyway. So he called them the Sadducees and scribes. And so this is not a public meeting. It says specifically he did it in secret. Just like Joseph married Mary in secret, or divorced, was going to divorce Mary in secret. So he asked them, where is this Messiah person supposed to be born? And the answer in Matthew, what does Matthew refer us to directly?
To Micah.
Micah chapter 5.
Yeah.
And I'll just read the first couple verses. As for you, Bethlehem Ephrata, seemingly insignificant among the clans of Judah, from you a king will emerge who will rule over Israel on my behalf. One whose origins are in the distant past. Now that's also interesting there.
Kedem.
Yeah. Mime Kedem. This is Kedem, the same word, but not in place in time. As I said, it could be both. But you have this, that would be very weird. What do you mean his origins are from the distant past? So the Lord will hand the people of Israel over to their enemies until the time when the woman in labor gives birth. Also very strange. But if you look at the passage before in Micah, it's talking about, it could be talking about Jerusalem's suffering, comparing it to a woman in labor. So theoretically, after the time of Jerusalem's suffering. Then the rest of the king's countrymen will be returned to be reunited with the people of Israel. He will assume his post, this king. He will assume his post and shepherd the people by the Lord's strength, by the sovereign authority of the Lord his God. So this vision of a king, according to Micah, and according to the scribes, is this anointed one. It's a future type of David who is going to set things straight.
That shepherds the people. Is that a linkage with Yeshua saying, "I am the good shepherd"?
Sure. And in the Old Testament, it's repeatedly an image used of a king. If you look in 2 Samuel 5:2. In times past, when Saul was king over us, it was you who led out and brought in Israel. And the Lord said to you, he's talking to David here, you shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over Israel. So the term shepherd is often linked with kingship. Also in Ezekiel, you know, my people are like sheep scattered on a hill with no shepherd.
And often in various countries, prince means king. You know, in England, we have a king, we have a queen, and down there we have a prince. But prince in some countries does actually mean king, top dog, in the word.
Yeah. But England in modern history is a little far away from ancient Israel.
Agreed. That's the letters.
Yeah. Okay. Let me see if there's something else. Gary, what were you bringing up from Micah earlier?
The Kedem.
Ah, the Kedem, yeah.
That east means ancient.
Mm-hmm. And that and Micah 5 is being interpreted messianically.
And question.
Yeah.
How do we know when, or what's the process for when these prophetic texts seem to be talking about just a king, a future ruler that's going to bring us back from exile, something like that? When do these crystallize into something that's defined as a single messianic eschatological figure? This is a pretty big stretch.
It probably depends on how you date the various sources we have. The Dead Sea, people were already doing it. In the Dead Sea letters, we have the Greek translation. Depending where you're reading, like in the Numbers passages, that translation in the Greek happened 250 BC. So that's pretty old compared to Jesus. Some of the other translations of the books, you know, maybe are a little later, but I would say all of them before Jesus' time. And then you have the Aramaic translations, Targumim, that of course were written down later, but they were also, they reflected a tradition of interpretation that was preserved over time. So an exact date when they started to be understood this way, it's hard to come by.
Well, probably after the destruction of the temple and starting to, you know,
which destruction?
The Babylonian destruction.
The Babylonian, okay.
That throws the whole world in chaos for the Jewish people.
And the interesting thing is, like, a lot of these books prophesying Edom's defeat because of what they turned over their brother Judah. Edom, the kingdom of Edom was defeated, you know? And yet Edom came to represent all the Goyim, all these other nations. And so Rome becomes Edom. And so the next time the oppressors, whoever they are, can be compared to Edom. So it's like one of these prophecies that can keep being fulfilled by different people. In much the same way that Amalek, the prophecy against Amalek, keeps being repeated and refulfilled in the story of Esther. Haman is from Agag, who is the king of Amalek. And so you have these ancient tensions refulfilled. Okay. so I guess we're out of time. By the way, how many wise men came? We don't know. That's right. That's the right answer. At least one. Well, it's plural. At least two. At least two. Two or more. The tradition for three, of course, comes from the three gifts they brought.
Why do you say at least two?
Because it says magi. It's plural. It wasn't magos.
Thank you.
Yeah. So.
But I bet it was more than three.
Yeah.
Any above all three.
If I was in a caravan holding large amounts of gold or incense, I would want to have more than three people through the Arabian Desert myself. I would want to have a caravan with me.
It can be his assistants.
Can be what?
The wise man's assistants.
Yeah, the wise man's assistants. That's right. So we'll have to close here, but keep thinking about these connections as you think about Jesus. My main point. Well, in thinking about where the wise men come from, it brings up many biblical themes and many passages that we should be thinking about that were perceived to foretell the coming Messiah. And two of those key passages, one's quoted directly, is Micah 5, verses 1 through 5. And notice Matthew doesn't quote it exactly, he tweaks little things. So if you go back and read the two passages, you get something from the comparison. And the other thing, of course, just the fact that these wise men coming from the east, it brings back huge themes of Jacob and Esau. It brings back Bilam, this eastern prophet who foresees a star. And, of course, Matthew's the one that mentions a star. Luke never mentions that. So Matthew is definitely showing us a particular angle. He wants you to keep in mind many of these biblical traditions so that when you look at Jesus' birth, it kind of snaps out in a new light, and you see, aha, you know, this is the Messiah, and these are some of the signs and some of the links that you can see backwards.
Do you know where Matthew was born?
No.
Okay.
I know that he likes to quote the Bible.
It's got a Jewish name, so.
It's got a Jewish name. And he tends to, he knows.